May it please the court, good morning. On behalf of the appellee, Jermaine Wright, I am Herbert Mondros. With me at council table is Billy Nolas and Tracy Olstead. And with the court's permission, Mr. Nolas would be presenting the argument on behalf of the appellee.
You're always welcome.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Good morning. May it please the court, Mr. Chief Justice. Paul Wallace on behalf of the appellant, State of Delaware, in this matter. On January 14th of 1991, Philip Seifert was killed. Within 2 weeks, Jermaine Wright was identified, gave a statement, about 40 minutes, videotaped, and confessed to that crime. He tried desperately through two suppression hearings, a trial, a first post-conviction hearing, a second post-conviction hearing, federal habeas petitions, all to discount that statement. Always in some way telling a court that statement should have never come in. And the crux of it was always voluntariness, and I didn't understand what rights I was waiving. He did it in the Superior Court. He argued it in this court. There's two very disturbing things about why we are here today. The first is, and this is Rule 61 and we're on a fourth post-conviction, and I could spend probably an hour talking about the procedural posture and the procedural bars, but the court really wants to get to the merits, and so does the state, because the most disturbing thing is how wrong the Superior Court was on the law related to the two claims, how wrong the court was in analyzing, even if it was direct appeal and it was merits-based, on Miranda and voluntariness, and how wrong on Brady. The application in these cases, especially at this point, at this procedural posture, gives little confidence that we can, that the rules mean anything, that the bars mean anything, because basically the quote new evidence that got us here was nothing but a rehash. More experts. It became an arms race. If we can bring more experts just to say what Dr. Maslowski said at the suppression hearing to try and prop him up, then maybe we can get rid of this statement. That's not new evidence. That's new packaging. And it should not be permitted. But to get to the merits, even if we accept that packaging, one of the things that the judge in this case relied heavily on was a perhaps miswording during the Miranda statement, during the Miranda warnings. He has resolved that question as to whether the word was diligent or indigent. One of the reasons that Jermaine Wright has never been successful through all of those layers of proceedings is this. And if we read the 1992 opinion of this court, it's very clear that the court saw that. And that is his statement, the videotape statement, where he confesses to killing Philip Seifert. These experts would like you to say that you cannot believe your eyes. That, look at that yawn, that means he's coming down from heroin. Although they can't tell you how much he had, where it was, or anything. It is not, under the totality of circumstances, an involuntary statement or a statement that's so infected by a miswording of Miranda that it should have been suppressed. And
well,
that Miranda
question... Did Judge Del Pesco actually rule on either of those?
Yes, absolutely. I'd suggest, first of all, as to the voluntariness, in 1991 was the first ruling in the suppression hearing. Went directly to Dr. Medlowski, the expert who testified for the third person and whom they then tried to prop up with other experts. She heard directly from him about heroin intoxication and his state, whether or not he could knowingly and voluntarily waive Miranda. Heard it in 1991. Heard it in the second suppression proceeding before trial. Heard it in the, at least, very least, the second post-conviction. And in fact, if you read the 1998 decision, The court made it very clear, this was after the second penalty phase, on the second post-conviction proceeding, Judge Del Pesco makes specific findings about the knowing and intelligent waiver of Miranda. It's a Westlaw site, so it's star five. Back the heading, knowing and intelligent waiver. Mr. Wright attempts to make some headway out of saying, well, we're not really talking about the voluntariness of the statement. We're talking about the knowing and intelligent waiver. If you read Judge Del Pesco's decision in 1998, she puts that to bed right away. There is no difference between those two. A knowing and intelligent waiver is a way to ensure the voluntariness of the statement. This court said as much in Marine, that basically without those procedural safeguards, that in fact it's not a voluntariness statement. It's all the same argument. It is simply an I-4 repackaging. And it's a claim that you should allow me to I-4 repackage, get that bar, because in the interest of justice, I have all these new experts who say this. The state suggests that while I don't want to rely necessarily on the procedural bar, it is disturbing to get to that point where basically it becomes an arms race of, if we can repackage and just bring in more people to say the same thing on our fourth go-around, maybe we can get rid of the piece of evidence that was subject to suppression hearing to this court's decision on direct appeal. This court on direct appeal said, and that's another disturbing part of it, is that the judge threw out some of the factual findings of Judge Del Pesco made at the time of the suppression hearing. He says, well, Mr. Wright only really got two Miranda warnings. I think Moser's testimony at trial is the most credible. He wasn't there for that testimony, by the way. But Judge Del Pesco found three Miranda warnings. This court found as a fact or in direct appeal three Miranda warnings. That's after the trial testimony that the judge somehow relied upon in this case. And then during this Rule 61 hearing, Moser again said, look, I did. I read a Miranda. That was what I did. Here's why I do that. I know he got it before. I want to make sure that I go through it again. So when we look at the totality of the circumstances that Judge Del Pesco looked at, she looked at that in 1998 when there were claims about his age, about his heroin use, and she made findings about the fact that this was a person who, although he was 18, had been Mirandized before. He understood them. He waived them.
Mr. Wallace, apart from the procedural bar arguments, which I think we grasp, you're also claiming that there was error in with respect to the merits-related decisions.
Yes, Your Honor.
And would you tell us, very concisely what you claim those errors were?
Yes.
And in particular, your position regarding the Samuels evidence.
I'm sorry.
The Samuels.
Okay. Well, as to the Samuels evidence, Your Honor, we claim the court did not error there because the court found that in fact there was no deal, there was no Brady violation. We would agree with that. We know that they wish to re-argue that on appeal, although they didn't file a cross-appeal on it. The merits argument as to Miranda, the state's suggestion is if you look at this opinion, there is no mention, zero mention, of any of the more recent Miranda cases which specifically go to what happens when you have some minor error in the recitation of Miranda by a police officer. Florida versus Powell, the most recent decision. In determining whether police officers adequately conveyed the four warnings, we have said reviewing courts are not required to examine the words employed, quote, as if construing a will or defining the terms of an easement. The inquiry is simply whether words reasonably convey the suspect his rights as required by Miranda. Duckworth had almost the same precise error, and yet the court really didn't do anything to analyze what happens if you have that minor error. The court said, there's this minor error, I'm done. Miranda violation, I'm done. And it was his own sua sponte decision. Even though courts before had looked at it time and time again, noticed nothing wrong with Miranda, made a totally different factual finding. And Warren, a Third Circuit case in 2011, said, look, even when it's not the clearest recitation, the question is, do you hit all the bases? And in reality, for Wright, he hit all the bases. And in the totality of circumstances, given the fact that he had been Mirandized, that was the third time that day, given the fact that even the alleged error in Miranda would have been that the state will give you, if you are an indigent, they will give you court-appointed counsel. Now, perhaps Jermaine Wright really wasn't all that concerned about that particular right anyway, because he didn't use court-appointed counsel. We found out later in his suppression hearing, he said, yeah, I've heard of public defenders. I don't...
Okay, so one of your claims is that there was no error in the Miranda warning, but even if there was, it was immaterial.
Yes. It certainly was not to the constitutional
measure. Are there any other merit-based claims of error?
The second is to the application of Brady as to the Brandywine Valley Liquor Store. The court set an incredible... I'm sorry, here.
I don't mean to step on Justice Jacobs' toes, but before we get away from the Miranda...
Yes, Your Honor.
Could you just tell me, I understood that there were three times that Wright was Mirandized, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
Is there any dispute as to the other two times, whether there was any error in the language that was used?
Well, they were not taped, so... As to Merrill, Detective Merrill gave it to him first when he first spoke to him. That was approximately 9 a.m. That's when, well, I'm sorry, at approximately noon is, I believe, when the very first attempt to try to speak to him was. Detective Merrill, the Newcastle County Police, said he was investigating the Emil Watson shooting and said, I Mirandized him. There's no question as to whether that Miranda was valid, although... It's the police officer's testimony, so we don't have the same level of it.
And then the second time?
The second time was with Detective Moser. This judge threw that one out and said, I don't think that happened. I know that
was there evidence to contradict Detective Moser's statements?
Well, Detective Moser at the suppression hearing said, yes, I read him Miranda. In fact, I did a written Miranda form with him, although it's unclear where that written Miranda form went after that. At trial, there was some questioning about Miranda, very little during cross-examination, and I believe he said, I did not Mirandize him. It was set aside at that point, and as the court might imagine, at the suppression hearing, whether or not he gave Miranda and what was said and everything like that is kind of a key point of the testimony.
Okay, so just to kind of simplify things, we've got one Miranda warning that, although there's no tape of it, there's also nothing to dispute the evidence that it was properly given.
Yes.
We've got a second one where there could be a basis to say, since there were inconsistent statements, that maybe we shouldn't count that one. And then there's the third one that's on the tape.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. Now go back to the Brady question.
Okay. So I don't, although I might confuse matters more, this was not the first time he was Mirandized ever in his life.
Right.
There's also evidence of priors. So I apologize. Getting back to the Brady and the Brandywine Valley Liquor Store. The bar that the court had set is this. If the state thinks at any point or checks to see whether there's a relationship between two crimes, but finds there's absolutely no relationship between those two crimes, it must turn that over. If, in fact, there's evidence of, basically, here's what happens. 40 minutes before, two young black males with a gun try to rob Brandywine Valley Liquor Store.
Right, we're at least I'm, you know, familiar with the facts that set forth in the briefs. The other side, they're in their brief, discusses an internal report or memorandum which shows that the police had drawn a connection between the two, at least for purposes of investigation.
In early investigation, in the day of.
Okay. And so to say that that there was no arguable connection seems to be undercut by that evidence, even though it is the case that the police later concluded that there wasn't any connection.
Your Honor, first of all, that... and I believe it's at B-16 and 17, was the actual investigative report of Detective Mayfield, something I would you know, that's regularly turned over in discovery and the defense had. I can't tell the court specifically whether they did or not, but I find it hard to believe in a capital murder case they didn't have the investigative report of the chief investigating officer. That just makes zero sense. And early on, Detective Mayfield notes in that report itself, talk to Wilmington police because, you know, you had two somewhat similar crimes.
And your response is that investigative report was turned over?
As I stand here, I can't be clear whether or not it was or not, Your Honor. I find it hard to believe that it wouldn't be. But
there's nothing in the record that shows
there's nothing in the record one way or the other, that it was either withheld or that it was turned over. There were other, you know, as I think we felt much more comfortable in our briefing saying, they knew from news media that people had said, hey, look, two similar crimes happened close together.
Now, what shows that they actually knew? Are those articles somehow in the record in support of a motion of some kind?
Not that I'm aware of, Your Honor, no.
So but how do you get to the point that Mr. Willard knew about those articles?
Well, the question isn't whether he knew. The question is whether he had equal access. And if it's a publicly known document, he has just as much access as anybody else to get it. And so the question is whether or not the state was suppressing things. One, they put it in the report. Two, it was, you know, there was at least a news media that, hey, there was some type of robbery that involved two black males also at the Brandywine Valley Liquors that same night.
Well, that's not really the question, is it? Whether the state's suppressing something. The question under Brady is whether you had a duty to disclose it. So, as I understood your first answer, if everything went according to course, the investigative report would have been produced. And then you could argue there was no Brady violation because we turned it over.
Right.
So why can't we get a definitive answer to that? It was either turned over or it wasn't.
Unfortunately, Your Honor, because this is a 20-year-old case and the trial files in this case have been through numerous hands. There's not a log of specific discovery materials given. So I do not know. I don't know whether Mr. Willard was asked whether he received that report in discovery or not.
Well, let's look hypothetically at other Brady cases. Let's suppose there was a situation where the police arrest the defendant. But early on, they thought they had another suspect, and they just conclude the other suspect wasn't worth pursuing, that the defendant was really the one who perpetrated the crime. Under Brady, what's your view about whether there's an obligation to tell the defense that at one time there was another suspect?
I think it would you're not going to like this answer, Your Honor, but I think it would depend. It would depend on the nature of the information that they had that brought it together. If on the evening of this event they hear there's a robbery here and there's a robbery here, there's two black males involved in this one, there's two black males involved in this one, there's a gun here, there's a gun there, and then immediately they look at it. And if you look at the reports, there's totally different clothing. In fact, the eyewitness at Highway Inn, Mr. Hummel, says the person's all in dark, both persons were all in dark clothing. There's different descriptions of them. They want to say, oh, well, they're very similar in person. Look at them, they truly aren't. If, in fact, the police do their due diligence at first and say, all right, well, things are coming in fast and furious that night, and we check on it real quick and realize two totally different things, I suggest there's no obligation whatsoever. The mere fact that at some point the police did their job to say, these two connected or not, I suggest doesn't invoke Brady, because otherwise it would be impossible. Every robbery that would have happened that night that might have involved two black males and a gun would have to be turned over. The mere fact that the police said at first, like I said, in the heat of the night in an investigation to say, any connection? And then realizing quickly that there is none, the state suggests respectfully does not invoke some Brady obligation to turn that over, because it doesn't become material. It's not exculpatory.
Let's assume, for the sake of argument, that we were to agree with the trial judge that there was a Brady violation. Does that determination lend itself, or can it be subjected to harmless error analysis?
Yes, I believe it can. And when you look at the other evidence, let's look at the defense case already. The defense had already tried to pin it on other people, Kevin Jameson. They had alibi. They had there was a full "it wasn't me and other people did this" type claim. The problem also, I suggest it is subject first to a harmless error analysis, and in this case, it would be harmless. I don't even know that this would have been admissible, and that's certainly part of Brady. Whether or not this, the fact that another robbery, because by the time you then unfold everything and you have two different clothing descriptions, you have one happening with a car, one they don't leave in a car, and all of the other differences, you don't simply get to put on, hey gosh, some other guys must have done this or could have done this because there happened to be a robbery. Look at the flip, as the state had suggested. If I had indicted him for Brandywine Village liquor stores on just that evidence, I have a feeling we would not have a very, very pleasant conversation down here about the joinder of those offenses and me trying to prosecute him for Brandywine Village liquors. They want to say that doesn't count, though. That doesn't matter.
Mr. Wallace, is the Brady request and the state's actual response of record, assuming there was a request, is that of record?
I'm unsure, Your Honor. I don't know. I would have to go back and look at to see the specific discovery responses.
In terms of the Rule 61 aspect of it, has this Brady issue been decided before? The Brady issue, has it been considered before?
No, this would have been the first time that it was considered in this fourth, Your Honor.
So are there any procedural bars that apply to the Brady issue?
Well, that it could be I-2 or I-3. I-1 certainly applies because of timeliness. But depending, for instance, on the knowledge of trial counsel, if in fact he had that detective's report and the detective's report says right there, hey, we talked about whether or not these two were connected and immediately came up with they weren't, you have a serious I-3 problem there.
Do you want to save your 3 minutes?
I would, Your Honor. Thank you.
I'm sorry. Did you have another question?
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court, thank you for allowing us to appear again, Your Honor. Let me jump right to the Brady claim, but before I do that, let me first point out one fallacy that sort of permeates the state's briefing in this case and the state's presentation, which is that this is an intensely fact-based claim. Judge Parkins below reviewed this case in over 2 years, had extensive pre-hearing briefing, conducted a two-week evidentiary hearing, granted a continuance so that the state can present additional evidence, reviewed voluminous exhibits, observed the witnesses, made credibility findings, and ultimately wrote an opinion that I think is a model opinion from a superior court that has the law laid out, the credibility determinations, and the facts, and applies the law to those facts in a proper manner. As to Brady, the court made several facts that I think are dispositive and that Mr. Wallace hasn't really discussed today and not addressed in the brief. Number one dispositive fact is that this claim was not raised before, was not previously litigated, and is subject to a miscarriage of justice analysis. As Judge Parkins found, this Brady error undermines the fundamental integrity, reliability, and fairness of this conviction. And I'll talk in a minute why in the context of this trial it does so, why it's material. Judge Parkins specifically found as a fact that the Brady evidence in this case puts the whole case in such a different light as to undermine confidence in the conviction, and at length, over 20 pages, discussed why this is so in light of the original trial evidence and in light of the nature of the Brady evidence. Judge Parkins specifically found that the state's case at trial was not a strong one. And he explained why. There was no fingerprint evidence, there was no hair evidence, there was no fiber evidence, no blood, no identification from the two witnesses at the scene connecting.
Do you have a reference in the record to the actual request and the response of the state?
No, Your Honor, I do not. I know that Mr. Willard did testify that he would have used this information, and it's very clear, as I'll talk about from the trial evidence, that he would have, but the record doesn't include the original state's response. And that's something that, you know, is why the state has a responsibility to maintain records, so that we can make a showing today as to what was actually provided with Mr. Willard, to Mr. Willard. What we know with confidence is Mr. Willard did not receive the Brandywine evidence, and Mr. Willard would have used the Brandywine evidence because those are Judge Parkin's findings.
And that's based on Mr. Willard's testimony?
That's based on Mr. Willard, and that's based on Judge Parkin's review of the overall record in the case and what was provided. Note that the one police report that Mr. Wallace referred to, prepared by Detective Mayfield, does not mention Brandywine by name. And so that in and of itself, even if that was provided, there's no confirmation that it was provided, but even if it was, it doesn't mention Brandywine by name to Mr. Willard. Now, put in the context of this case.
Why is the name significant?
The name that it was Brandywine Liquors, yeah, as opposed to looking into another robbery? I think it might be. I don't think it makes or breaks the case one way or the other, but it might be if it said Brandywine. But it didn't. It didn't say Brandywine by name. It says that Detective Mayfield met with detectives from Wilmington in reference to another matter. But it doesn't lay out all of the details that have been heard in this Rule 61 proceeding, where the claim was heard for the first time. You all held in Jackson that a Brady claim, if it's colorable, if it's meritorious, is not subject to procedural bar and should be entertained on the merits. And we've cited Jackson in the brief, and that's exactly what Judge Parkins did below. And he did it in the context of this trial. And in the context of this trial, this is a case where there was alibi evidence presented by Mr. Willard for both Mr. Wright and for his co-defendant, Mr. Dixon. And it wasn't just fly-by-night alibi evidence. By way of example, if for Mr. Dixon, there was evidence presented that he was at a movie and he had the witnesses from the movie. Then Mr. Dixon's account was in his statement that he went to a bar and he ordered exotic drinks. And Mr. Willard actually brought the bartender in to say that he remembered an African-American person and his girlfriend coming in because he had to look up the drinks. They were confirming the account that they were exotic drinks they were ordered. Four witnesses provided an alibi for Mr. Wright for the evening in question. Mr. Willard also attempted to implicate Jameson, somebody who now 10 witnesses have said may have been the person who did the crime. And I'll talk in a minute about Mr. Jones, the witness named to Jameson, to the Jameson matter. And you put that in context as Mr. Willard saying, no, this is not my client doing this crime, with what the Brady evidence is. And the Brady evidence is that a mile and a half, and these are Judge Parkin's findings, a mile and a half from the Highway Inn, two African-American males commit a very similar attempted robbery at Brandywine. The descriptions match almost to a T. The witnesses, and the Judge Parkin's findings are, and the evidence confirms, the witnesses, Deborah Milner and George Hummel, describe the shorter assailant as 5'8", 160 pounds, the taller one as 6 foot, 170 pounds. Mr. Baxter, the witness from the Brandywine, describes the shorter one as 5'8", 160 pounds. Well, exactly the same description. And the taller one as 5'10", 6'170.
That evidence, if it were available and had been used as part of the defense, presumably would have been introduced to negate, well, in order to inject reasonable doubt. That is, that evidence together with the alibi evidence, which is, I take it, would have shown, number one, that Jermaine Wright wasn't there, and number two, other people who closely fit the description could well have been the perpetrators. If that evidence were the only evidence in a vacuum, you know, as to who else might have done this killing, I can understand the argument. But there's a complication here, and that is that there was evidence introduced that two other specific individuals performed the homicide. And to use your words, that wasn't fly-by-night evidence either, was it? I mean, there were specific people that to whom the defense pointed
and
fingers.
And Jameson and Custis, who Your Honor is referring to, could well have fit the description of the Brandywine assailants. In other words, let me put it this way. Mr. Willard puts on Mr. Jones as a witness in the trial.
Well, before you respond, let me make sure that my question is out there.
Yes, sir.
And that is that even if the Brady information had been made available, defense counsel would have had to make a tactical decision as to whether to use it. And I mean, they weren't going to put in the evidence pointing the finger at those other two gentlemen and then argue to the jury, well, you know, if you don't believe this, let's try something else. You know, how about what happened at the liquor store a mile and a half down the road?
And Justice Jacobs, that may be true hypothetically, but as Judge Parkins found, it's not true on the record in this case. Mr. Willard put on Mr. Jones, and just stay with me with this. Mr. Willard put on Mr. Jones. Mr. Jones was a witness who said, Jameson showed me the gun he used at the Highway Inn murder. That gun is black, has a long barrel, and is a .22. And he told me that's the gun he used. The gun that Mr. Baxter at the Brandywine offense says is the gun that he saw is black and has a long barrel. And it's a .22 that's used at the Highway Inn. In other words, the Brandywine evidence...
So what follows from that?
What follows from that is it fits what Mr. Willard was putting on at the trial. So, it's not so some evidence of necessarily...
Are you saying that, that we would have to conclude as a matter of law that if this Brady information had been made available, that that information would have been the subject matter of the defense rather than what actually was... submitted to the jury in terms
just,
of who
just
else
as Jacobs, not as a matter of law, but as a matter of your review of Judge Parkins' specific findings of fact. His findings of fact are that Mr. Willard would have used the evidence, that would have, it would have buttressed the defense presented at trial, it would have enhanced the defense, and it would have been material and undermines confidence in the result, especially
so you're
given
that Judge Parkins made a factual finding that if this evidence had been available, had been turned over, that in fact Mr. Willard would have made a tactical decision to use it rather than the evidence that in fact was used?
Judge Parkins did not phrase it that way, but permeating those 20 pages of Judge Parkins' ruling are that the evidence would have been used by counsel at the trial. That's
well,
the very point
you're,
of the
you were telling me, or at least I understood you to be telling me, that there was a factual finding, but there isn't. That is, we would have to speculate, would we not, that that evidence would have been used.
I'm sorry.
And you know, if that is not clear, then the question becomes, if there was Brady error here, was it harmful?
Well, no. Those are two different questions. If the question is, would Mr. Willard have used it, and that the current opinion from Judge Parkins does not have sufficient clarity in that regard, then I suggest the court's option is to remand the matter for Judge Parkins to make a factual finding question, would Mr. Willard have used this evidence? And Judge Parkins knows the record inside out. He can do that very quickly and report back to the court. That's not a legal question. That's a specific factual question.
If, as a legal matter, there was a Brady error here, but we were to conclude that there's no basis to find that the Brady information would, in fact, have been used as part of the defense case, then is the error reversible?
There are two answers to that. One is the legal answer looks to if there is Brady error, what would a reasonable defense counsel have done with the evidence? How would it affect the investigation, the preparation, and the trial presentation? And therefore, you don't simply lock into the original record in that regard. The question is, had this evidence been provided legally to trial counsel, is there a reasonable probability
that's very nice, Mr. Knowles, but that's not what I asked you.
I'm sorry, Your Honor? I misunderstood.
The second question.
Yes, sir.
Which is, after counsel does all that, and if counsel decides not to use that information, the Brady information, then is the Brady error harmful?
If counsel had this information and had made a tactical choice not to use it, then the Brady error is not Brady error, of course. But that's not the record that you have. The record that you have are considerations by Judge Parkins that a reasonable counsel would have used it. And on the record, it's very clear that Mr. Willard would have used it. Mr. Willard himself says that. And to the extent that your inquiry is a factual one, I suggest that that answer should be provided by Judge Parkins. If there's ambiguity in his opinion, let Judge Parkins provide the answer to that. Let Mr. Willard testify again. Those are two simple questions that I could ask
him. What answer did Judge Parkins provide up to this point?
Judge Parkins very clearly, in his opinion, demonstrates that Mr. Woolard would have used the evidence. That's what permeates the Brady analysis. He doesn't, there's no introduction that says, even though Mr. Woolard would not have used it, I'm going to go ahead and do a hypothetical Brady analysis. It's a given to Judge Parkins that Mr. Woolard would have used it.
And if the Brady information had been turned over, ergo, ipso facto, it would have been used.
If the Brady information had been turned over, Mr. Woolard would have used it in the context of this case, in the context of a case where Mr. Woolard's argument is, my client and his co-defendant did not do the offense. My client and the police believed early on, and the description of the witnesses is that the same individuals did the two offenses, and the police cleared Mr. Wright and Mr. Dixon of the Brandywine offense. In the context of this case, that's very compelling evidence that undermines confidence in the result, and that's what Judge Parkins found.
Assuming the evidence or information about the BVLS robbery was in the public and in the news media, where is the suppression element?
Judge Parkins made specific findings as to the news media, and he indicated that it was disingenuous on the part of the state to cite newspaper articles in this case, because those articles were made before Mr. Woolard was engaged in defense counsel.
Well, why does that matter if it's out in the public domain?
Because the United States Supreme Court in Banks versus Dredge has educated us that Brady doesn't stand for the proposition that the state may hide, so to speak, and defense counsel has a duty to turn over every stone, to look under every rock in an effort to find the evidence. Something that's reported in a newspaper article is not the same as disclosing to defense counsel by the state, here we have this information that you may want to look at. And that's what Banks versus Dredge holds. Counsel does not have a duty, for example, to go search other case files. Counsel does not have a duty to do an extensive newspaper search, and there's a specific finding from Judge Parkins that given this case and given the resources, the lack of resources that Mr. Woolard had, it is disingenuous to expect him to go and just simply read random newspaper articles in the hopes of finding some Brady evidence. And Mr. Woolard did investigate. He did exercise...
But wouldn't he read the articles about his own client? Help me clarify this.
The articles about the Brandywine information.
Was the article a reference to both cases at the same time?
There were articles that indicated that there was an article that indicated that law enforcement was looking into another possible offense. And that's the extent of the article. And so the question is, from that, is that sufficient to somehow cover the state's duty to disclose? In Banks, again, the United States Supreme Court had said that the duty's on the state not to be turned on its head and to see if counsel has this some extensive duty to go way out of counsel's way in an effort to ferret out every potential item of evidence. In addition, the Supreme Court has held that Mr. Woolard, all defense counsel, have the right to rely on the good faith of the prosecution. So I got to tell you, if I'm defense counsel, we don't know this from the record, but if I'm Mr. Woolard and I read an article that talks about some other offense, and the state, the Attorney General's office, doesn't provide me Brady about that, I have the right to presume that those are not connected. That's what the Supreme Court has held. It has held that counsel has the right to rely on the good faith of the prosecution.
Can you help me reconcile what appears to be two different counsel arguing from the same record but not agreeing that the record says the same thing at all? We just heard from the appellant. The appellant says the two incidents are, quote, totally different, close quote. And because they're totally different, there's no likelihood that even if this information had been turned over, that a trial judge would have allowed it to be admitted. You've just described similarity in weapon and similarity in identification. How do I put together the statement that they're totally different and the statement that they have facts in common?
Let me answer your question, Mr. Chief Justice, and then let me go through the similarities for a minute, because I started to do that and kind of got distracted by some other thought that popped in my head. The way to resolve that is the way you always do as an appellate court. One side says A, the other side says B. You look at what the findings are from the trier of fact. Is it A or is it B? And in this case, the resolution has been made by Judge Parkins. Judge Parkins listened to the state's argument. Judge Parkins listened to the defendant's argument. And Judge Parkins picked B over A. And so to the extent that Mr. Wallace can make a coherent argument, taking some of the facts and laying them out in his favor, and to the extent that I can take facts and lay them out in my favor and make a coherent argument in that regard, it doesn't matter a lick, because you're not the trial court. You're not the ones who are making the original determination. And you have held that in a Rule 61 appeal, where there was a trial, and the trial in this case is the hearing, and where there are findings of fact and credibility determinations, you don't review the original record. You don't review whether Mr. Wallace or whether myself and Mr. Mondros have the better argument on the facts. You review the findings of fact of the Superior Court for clear error. And what is clear error? Clear error means that Judge Parkin's findings, the state would have to show to you, Judge Parkin's findings lack record support. Well, they don't, because as you just said, I presented a different version of the facts. The state would have to show that Judge Parkins was capricious or arbitrary in his fact findings. There's fact findings, you look in the record and they're just not there. He just made them up out of whole cloth. Plainly, that's not the case. Judge Parkins cites specific testimony, cites specific exhibits, and makes credibility determinations. So yes, Mr. Chief Justice, there is a debate, and if you were a trial judge, you would say, okay, let me cut through this debate and try to sort it out, because there's something for Mr. Wallace and there's something for the appellee in this case, but that's not your function as a reviewing court.
Was
as
it
a reviewing court, your function is to look at what Judge Parkins determined. I'm sorry, Your
Honor. I take what you just said, and then let's go to the ultimate question. Would it have been admissible at trial, this Brady information, and if so, why?
And Judge Parkins found, and I respectfully submit, it absolutely would have been admissible. Number one, you have close proximity, a half hour from one offense to the other, from Brandywine to the Highway Inn. You have 30 minutes time difference. So it's close in location and close in time. They happen approximate to each other. You have similar descriptions of the assailants. You have Milner, the barmaid at the Highway Inn, saying that one of the African American who's not known came into the bar and was wearing something red. She described it as a red flannel shirt, but at first she said something red. Mr. Baxter at the Brandywine offense says one of the assailants had something red on, had a red, what he described as a red coat. So there's similarity of descriptions of what they're wearing. There was one car involved in both cases. There was one gun in both cases. The descriptions from the witnesses match, both in heights, in terms of heights, and in terms of weights. One of them only is wearing a hat. That matches in the two descriptions. And so this is put in context of a trial where the defendant and the co-defendant have a strong alibi presented to the jury by Mr. Willard. And where Mr. Willard is also presenting a witness that says there's a third party who had a gun that was used at the Highway Inn offense, and that gun, the description of the gun given by that witness, matches the gun used at the Brandywine offense, the gun that Mr. Baxter said he saw. It's a long-barreled black handgun. And so it matches. And in the context of this case, the question isn't, has the Brady claim been proven to beyond a reasonable doubt have changed the verdict, or is it conclusive that no judgment of guilt could be imposed but for the Brady error itself? The question is, does it undermine confidence in the result? In the context of a trial where the court allows evidence of an alibi and allows evidence that a third party did it with a description of that third party's gun, evidence that potentially matches that third party to another robbery, and evidence that the people who did that other robbery could very well be the people who committed this homicide, certainly would have fit with what Mr. Willard had tried to present. And certainly, I can't imagine how a trial court would have excluded it without committing error. It would be excluding, as the United States Supreme Court said in Crane versus Kentucky, it would have been excluding key defense necessary for the defendant to put forth his account to the jury. And if that were the case, I wouldn't want to be the state in a direct appeal where a trial judge excluded the Brandywine evidence. So, again, the question is not, what do you think carries the day? The question is, when Judge Parkins made all of these assessments, made the credibility determinations, and ultimately determined that this error is material and that this evidence connects these two cases in a way that exculpates Mr. Wright, is that something that is clear error from the Superior Court? Judge Parkins is the person who makes the call. Judge Parkins listened to the evidence, and Judge Parkins made the call in a very well-reasoned opinion that we respectfully submit, Your Honors, should not disturb. There's one other aspect about the miscarriage of justice that overall permeates this case, and that's two things. Judge Parkins, in very, very careful detail, described why the confession is not reliable. why Mr. Wright's confession is not something that can be relied upon. And I'm sort of running out of time, so I'll have to end up with resting on my brief on the actual merits of the lack of a knowing, intelligent waiver and Miranda. But I will say something that is much, that is very worthy of consideration when you look at the Brady claim that I spent the bulk of my time on, and that is, as Judge Parkins found, Mr. Wright says things in that statement that are demonstrably false. He makes admissions that do not fit the facts. So, for example, he says that the offense was committed with a 38. The offense was committed with a 22. He says that when he gets what happened wrong. He says that when he was in the store, Mr. Dixon is yelling out instructions to him. Ms. Milner, the barmaid, says there was no yelling. There was no talk that she could hear. He says that the decedent was left on the floor. Actually, Mr. Hummel, the witness, came in much later, 10 minutes later, and the decedent is on a stool. He's not on the floor.
Judge Del Pesco knew all of that, didn't she?
Judge Del Pesco knew some of that, I have to say, in terms of the surprise. The point I was trying to make is that there are reasons to doubt the reliability of the confession for purposes of assessment of the Brady claim. So it's a different point. But getting to Judge Del Pesco, Judge Parkins explained, and the record clearly shows, that the statements issue was never addressed in the past, the issue upon which Judge Parkins ruled. On direct appeal, Mr. Wallace talked about your
direct... Judge Del Pesco did say that Miranda warnings were understood and voluntarily waived by your client.
And as Judge Parkins noted, Judge Del Pesco's analysis looked at police coercion. Judge Del Pesco did not look at the knowing, intelligent nature of the statement based on the evidence that Judge Parkins heard. But now, let me just not digress, too, because I see in a few seconds I won't have time to do justice to the Miranda and to the knowing, intelligent waiver claim. But let me just stay with the things for a moment that Mr. Wright said. Mr. Wright said they got there at 11:30. Actually, the assailants got there at 10:30. Mr. Wright said that they left in a Jetta. The car was a rabbit. He gets the car wrong. Mr. Wright says that they both went into the car, he and the co-defendant, and drove off together. Mr. Hummel, who was there looking at them, says one of them got in and drove off. The other one ran off. Mr. Wright says that the decedent was shot once. The decedent was actually shot three times. And there's evidence from Ms. Milner, who heard the shots, and he was in fact shot three times. And Mr. Wright says that I didn't have a hat on. Officer Mayfield says, are you sure? I think you did. Mr. Wright says, yes, I had the hat on. The evidence from both Brandywine and from both Highway Inn is that the taller guy had the hat, not the guy who went in. So
we're going to have to stop there.
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you very much. All I'm saying is, in assessing the materiality of the Brady evidence, the statement that Mr. Wright...
I said we had to close.
Thank you very much, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Jermaine Wright also knew things that only the murderer would know. Where was he shot? Watch the video. He shows exactly where Philip Seifert was shot in the back of the head. He demonstrates it. Says, yeah, got him. He was reaching like this, and he got him right here. That tape is probably, it's now a disc, it was a tape in 1992, is probably the best evidence that Jermaine Wright knowingly and voluntarily waived his Miranda warnings and gave a voluntary statement to the police. I don't know that I can understate what the state suggests is appropriate
in
Washington.
Tell us, Mr. Wallace, let's assume that you're right with regard, you're correct with regard to the statement, and the statement comes in, and let's assume hypothetically there was a Brady violation. Then where do we go?
Your Honor, I suggest respectfully, first of all, assuming that there's a Brady violation, I suggest in the totality of all of this, it is harmless at best. But to get to that Brady violation, we'd have to answer the question, for instance, the Chief Justice answered. Would this possibly come in? Mr. Knowles is correct as to the deference this court generally will give factual findings by lower courts. The other thing that this court does is see if the law was applied correctly. At page 79 of the court's opinion below, he says, however, there's a plausible argument that unsuccessful perpetrators at Brandywine Village struck at a second target not long thereafter. That's all he possibly says about the true materiality and how key this witness may be, a plausible argument. Well, when you lay that against the Brady law and its progeny, the mere possibility that an item of undisclosed information might have helped the defense does not establish materiality in the constitutional sentence. That's the United States Supreme Court at Aggers. Evidence is material only if there's a reasonable probability that the evidence had been disclosed to defense, the result of the proceeding would have been different. If you weighed this in, first, there's a very real question as to whether this could have possibly gotten in. And if you look, part of the problem is you would have had to have a mini trial of BVLS to see whether or not those could have been the same guys who did the other one. Mr. Nolas wants to talk about the barmaid, for instance. The barmaid didn't see the murders. She saw some guy who came in earlier into the bar part that she thought might have been suspicious. That's it. Mr. Hummel saw the people leaving in all dark clothing. The people at BVLS, one had a tan jacket with white pants. That's the shorter guy. At A3 in the appendix, the person at BVLS said it was a play gun. That's the very last line of the very first report taken on BVLS.
How would we distinguish, Mr. Wallace? We had a case where Mr. Hurley appealed and there was an ATM robbery and then a nearby bank robbery, and this court reversed and said the exclusion of the evidence was reversible error. You recall that case?
I recall it, as Your Honor just says. Unfortunately, I'm not as familiar with all the facts that I could probably lay them up against each other to say, well, there's so much similarity in description or whatever. But at this point, when we're talking about an A1, a claim that would be barred by A1, and I see I'm out of time, we suggest trying to lay that out and answer the questions that this would be material and it would be admissible. The court just got it wrong on the law there.
Do you believe you've answered Justice Ridgely's question?
I believe so. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Wallace. Thank you, counsel. The court will take the case under advisement and recess.